The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Welcome to the final episode of Underestimated, discussing the case of Jeanette Roberson. Thank you for remaining with us on this journey for justice and awareness for Jeanette. Through our episodes, we've explored various theories and developed a deeper understanding of how to create a suspect profile, which will be crucial in this final episode as we apply the key elements of this profile to analyze potential suspects and determine whether they match the characteristics and behaviors of the perpetrator.
Before we begin going through the list of suspects, we would like to play the recording of our discussion with Jim Clementi about his thoughts on our profile and what he would have done differently.
So anyway, let me just tell you, you did a really good job on, you know, laying out what the crime was, and the victimology was really good, and some interesting things in there, the murder itself and the crime scene, all that stuff is very well done. You know, you have the demographics in there, you have her risk assessment in there. That's all really well done. And I'll just go through notes that I've sort of put in throughout this. I've highlighted a bunch of it, but obviously you can't see that. But I have a couple of questions as we go along. But one thing I wanted to ask is, did they test the half-eaten lunch at all? Or any kind of sleeping meds, drugs, GHB, anything like that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, and was there anything in her toxicology?
The only thing that came back was caffeine in her system, but that's because she had coffee earlier.
Okay, so at the bottom of the murder, this is the way that the body was found is typical of a younger male offender. It could be staged, it could be some other situation, but this type of exposure and pulling the shirt up and the pants down is something that male offenders will commonly do. Just letting you know. So when we get to the body, the injury, you know, the fractured and indented skull that caused the brain injury, it would take some time, maybe about 40 to 45 minutes for the brain to swell enough to cause death from this type of wound. This is very similar to how JonBenet Ramsey died. And it takes some time. Did they test the contents of her stomach? Did they say how much that food was digested that she ate?
It was brown mush, so it was already pretty much decomposed.
But yeah. It was in her stomach? Was it in her duodenum? Was it in the large intestine, small intestine?
It was still in her stomach, but it had broken down to the point of just kind of being, I don't remember the term they used, but yeah, like basically like brown mush in her stomach, but it was still in her stomach.
And what time did she normally take lunch?
She usually took her lunch around 2:45, so then she could pick up her kids.
But her husband came at 1, right?
Yeah, because he was laid off that week.
Right, but...
So she didn't have to pick up the kids.
Yeah, she didn't. So she most likely just took her lunch at like a more regular time for someone working those hours.
Right. So the weapons used, there's this fork tool that you used to clean aquariums, right? She was strangled. That's manual. The hyoid bone was fractured. That's significant because it takes a lot of force to do that. And it means they meant what they were doing. And that would cause the bruising in the petechiae. And she was sliced up with what's believed to be a box cutter, a razor weapon. And then there's some kind of pole-like weapon that was used. Out of all these weapons, the box cutter seems to me to be the one that the offender may have brought with them. And contrary to what I think you've said, I believe that that was what was used to control the victim and get her into the more private work area behind the cages. I just think it's a much more likely scenario for her to have been threatened to get back there rather than voluntarily going back there with someone, because there was plenty of privacy down there. It wasn't a place where she couldn't have a conversation. There wasn't anybody around at the moment, right? And it's a possibility that, you know, she went back there with them. But I also think the presence of this razor weapon, in my mind, I would lean towards it being a weapon used to coerce the victim to a more private area where the offender could do what the offender planned to do with her.
So do you think she was just like scared for her safety? Because we figured like she wasn't being threatened because she wasn't like screaming or nobody heard any raised voices from upstairs.
Okay. Do you remember 9/11? Do you know what 9/11 is?
Yeah, they weren't alive. Probably.
Well, 9/11, an average of 4 or 5 guys with razors were able to control hundreds of people and kill hundreds of people in each plane. Humans are more afraid of a knife than they are of a gun because most humans have gone through getting cut. They have physical bodily memories of being cut, and they know how easy that is to hurt them. Most humans have not been shot unless you're 50 Cent. So it is a very common and very effective tool for controlling someone. And if somebody pulled out a weapon to surprise her and said, if you say a word, I'll cut you, she could have gained control over him. Yeah, so, yeah, the notable behaviors, that's where I said, or the unsub had a weapon that was used to threaten and control her. So when you say here, body concealment, this indicates that obviously the killer knew they couldn't be caught with the body. I would change that language, is knew that they didn't want to be caught with the body. But I think you should also note that they did spend some time in the privacy of that back room doing a lot of bad things to the victim. There was, they took, a very unreasonable risk that anybody could walk down at any time and see them doing these things. They couldn't hide while they were doing those things to the victim, right? And so this is a very high risk action that puts the offender in a very high risk category. This is a very bold and risky venture. But typically, if, and I agree that it was most likely a blitz attack where they went into the room and immediately the offender hit the victim over the head, incapacitating her. And that could have been it. And maybe at that point, the strangulation was attempted. And maybe out of frustration, they went on to cut and stab the victim multiple times and to the insertion. I mean, that is an extremely violent act that takes a lot of motivation and takes a lot of strength to do, which I'll get to in a minute. But the fact that they only, well, in this highly risky environment, they only partially concealed the body. They temporarily concealed the body so that they could get away, right? And they felt that once they got away, there was a low likelihood that anyone would connect them to this victim at this time and place. So there may be a connection between them, but not a known connection at this time and place.
That's pretty much what you guys came up with.
Yeah.
Yeah, that there's some kind of connection. They know they can't be caught with the body.
Well, but like I said, can't be caught with the body sounds like it's not possible to catch them, but it's a highly risky environment. I would say did not want to be.
Right, caught. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what they were looking at was that they are, the body concealment was a method of creating distance between them and the body before it's discovered. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. When we get down to the immediacy of the initial attack, down there, I wrote the obvious signs of sexual assault with a non-human pole or pipe or whatever indicates either a male with erectile dysfunction or a female attacker. So I agree with you there. But when you say that the choice of a heavy blunt object speaks to the lack of physical strength, I don't agree with that. We have thousands of cases where big, strong, heavy guys pick up a rock or a cinder block or heavy pipe or some other heavy object from a house on the scene and do exactly what this unsub did. But the victim was very small, very light, so it wouldn't take much to, cause this kind of damage to her. But then they went above and beyond. So there was a blitz attack. I would call it a blitz attack. And that did incapacitate her, then I do believe that the attack following was with the unsub's hands. But then there is stomping and other very bad things that are going on. So that's either a manifestation of rage that was previously developed or out of frustration in the moment. So I just think it's important to cover both of those things as well. I think you're right about not showing any indications of remorse or undoing, but when you And when you say, you know, that the state of undress is intended to further humiliate her, I think that's correct. But I think the way that she was sexually assaulted was also, and much more so, a way to humiliate her. I also agree that the unsub did come to the store with violence in mind. But I do think they had a plan. I do think they came with that knife. And I do think, and I even believe, that it's possible that the husband coming with the lunch could have been to verify that she was there and that she was alone. I believe the attacker came shortly after the husband left. And this is, it is possible that he was involved in this, but not, you know, and I would certainly say that investigators should test that theory significantly. I'm not saying that he definitively was, but I also think it is a possibility. So if the offender found all the weapons, you said they were all found at the scene, but by the offender, not by law enforcement. They weren't left at the scene, right?
Correct. So,
but we don't know. I mean, how do we know that there was there a box cutter missing? Was there this forked weapon? Was there a pipe or pole missing? How are you making that determination that all the weapons used were found at the store?
That was based on what the original investigators, it's probably more theory than fact, you're right, but the assessment based on the medical examiner, as far as like the puncture marks, documented it in the autopsy as like a barbecue fork.
Right.
We measured them, and like I didn't put it into AI to find something that could fit that. And we found that there's this, you know, aquarium tool that would fit perfectly with it. But yeah, it was theorized by law enforcement back then that all of the weapons were improvised weapons from things at the crime scene. For example, I don't think it was mentioned in the report, but like where her head was bashed in, there was like flecks of green paint. I don't remember if we mentioned that or not in that. So they theorized that was one of the painted rocks that they use in the aquariums.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think some of them were, but I don't, given the level of violence that was displayed here and the rage and or frustration that was displayed here, I don't believe this is something that happened in the moment. In other words, somebody wandered down there and said, oh, look, a woman alone in this area. I'm going to bring her back to an area that, how do I know it's even safe back there for me to do what I'm going to do unless I have been here before or know the layout or somebody told me the layout? You know, I don't think it was a chance encounter and a totally impulsive act. I do believe that this unsub made an attempt to go at a time when she thought that, I mean, when the victim would be alone and when the likelihood of people coming in was lower and that they had an opportunity to do what they planned to do. So I think there was a plan. It wasn't very well thought out. It was very risky, but they were able to get away with it. I don't think that's because of criminal sophistication. I think it's sheer luck that nobody wandered down at that particular time when she was being forced to the back or being hit over the head or being sexually assaulted or being, you know, anything else. When the offender was really engaged in activity, any of those times, anybody could have walked back there and seen through the cages, right?
Yeah. That's kind of the same thing. Actually, the exact same words when we were doing the profile up on the whiteboard was that, like, they got away with it by dumb luck because, like, any of those people that came down looking for her, and there were a handful over the period of time when the offender had to have still been with her, any time one of them could have been like, well, look in the back. And they just got lucky that didn't happen.
Right. But yeah, I mean, they could have seen through the cages. They wouldn't have had to go through any doors or anything, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
So when you say under three in the location of the murder, the unsub did not have a close enough relationship with Jeanette that they had any other options to get Jeanette alone, they would not be welcome in her home, and they had no way of predicting where she would be at any given time. But that seems to be inconsistent with you saying that she voluntarily went back to the back with them to have a chat, and then they were blitzed attacked. So if there wasn't enough of a relationship between these two, then I don't believe she would have gone alone to a back area that's more insecure with somebody that she didn't have a good relationship with.
Yeah, that makes some sense. I think the conclusion they got to was that if it was someone that, you know, is at least on the periphery of their life, who they know each other, she knows who they are, but they have beef with them enough to where she's not going to go meet him in a coffee shop or whatever. But that does make more sense with what you're talking about with the knife used or the blade or whatever used as control, that might be enough to have coaxed her back into the back room.
I also think that, like, if it was, it could be someone that she would allow in her home, but they wouldn't go into their home to kill her, because then that would make them an obvious suspect. It could be someone that knew her and would be allowed in her home, but it would just be too obvious. So I think that
I just don't buy it. I don't buy that she voluntarily went back with this person to that room. If there wasn't enough of a close relationship, and if there was enough of a close relationship, I don't think this would have happened. So I do believe that this person more likely threatened, had very harmful, violent intent, and initiated the contact that way. That's just my profiler intuition. So
do you, on that lines, as far as the relational aspect of it, like if we're talking about where she was coaxed back or coerced back with a weapon, as far as kind of the main point of that section was that in order for her to have, for the offender to have that kind of anger towards her, there has to be some sort of relationship there, some sort of connection.
There was some prior motivation for this, yes. And actually, the next note that I have is this was an extremely high-risk attack. The chances of them being discovered during the attack were very high. For this reason, I believe the husband may have been involved, and the lunch visit was to determine that the victim was in the basement and alone, and that the actual offender, because of their lack of close relationship, could not be the one who did the pre-attack surveillance. I believe it would have alerted the victim to something bad. Anyway, if the husband was involved in pre-attack surveillance. I mean, these are possibilities that need to be investigated. And was it in fact that, or was it something? Was it his showing up just before this killer did? Just a coincidence. I'm not loving that. So, in the profile, how did you pick between 17 and 24?
We think that they most likely had to be out of high school, since the murder would have done the attack during school hours. But we also don't think they're on the younger side because of like how just impulsive and high, like risky the whole attack was.
I think you're right about that. But you also have to put in there that it could also be that riskiness and impulsivity could also be that they were under extreme stress or the influence of illicit drugs or alcohol, because that can also cause people to be more, to lower their inhibitions and take more risky actions. But although there's no indication that the offender was a male, other than choice of weapons, right? The weapons chosen by the sub are very rarely used by females. But I believe if the unsub was a female, she would be a rough and tough young woman. She would present as very brash and assertive. She would have a history of doing traditionally male-oriented activities. Her work would be in a male-dominated arena, perhaps as an apprentice to a car mechanic or a contractor or a plumber or in a warehouse or loading dock, something like that, versus, you know, a hairdresser or a nail salon or, waitressing. She would likely have a history of being a bully and being known to be physical and violent. And I agree, it's an extremely high-risk attack, that the chances of them being discovered during the attack were very high. And so that is an indicator of impulsiveness and disorganized. So it is likely that some of the weapons were actually taken from the actual scene, used in the attack and taken away from the scene. This reason, I do believe that there is a possibility that the husband was involved, and that it's a real sort of wrench in all of this, you know, in that if there was pre-attack surveillance, that's a little more organized than just somebody who is going to just react and respond and do something without thinking it through much. But I'm not exactly sure, but I would say that, yeah, the unsub, whether male or female, would be on the younger side of 20s, but she had a physicality and familiarity with weapons. She had a history of fights and violence and was likely a bully who was used to getting whatever she wanted by any means necessary. She, before the offense, I think you should add a section for pre-offense and post-offense behavior. Before the offense, I think she probably schemed and boasted that she would get back at this victim for whatever perceived slights or, you know, behavior. And after the murder, she went into panic mode. She's never gone this far before. She probably laid low, made excuses for not being where she would normally be expected to be. And she didn't return to, quote, normal until sometime after the murder, when things calmed down and she realized cops didn't come knocking on her door. She's not a suspect.
You had asked about the age range. You said kind of on the earlier side of the 20s. Do you think they were pretty spot on with kind of their assessment of that? I had them narrow it down to those dates because I just want to kind of think through that process, right? Like how young is too young? We came up with, high school was still in session, so let's say 17 or 18. How old is too old? 25 is when they say the prefrontal cortex starts really developing. So that's where they kind of came up with that range.
Right. But, you know, I think the extent to which they engaged in not overkill, but over assault, I think that takes a little, I mean, that's a lot of stuff for a young person, a very young person to engage in. And so it may be somebody a little bit older than 17, but it just depends on, you know, did this person grow up on a farm and was involved in all sorts of physical behavior and livestock killing and, you know, cutting skins and doing all that kind of stuff. You know, that's all a possibility. You know, it depends on what their upbringing was as to how easily they would go to that extent. I mean, I don't want to get too graphic, but what they did was very extreme. I mean, this is the kind of thing you see in the most extreme offenders. And so it could be either somebody who was, you know, exposed to that kind of physical, bloody, gory behavior early on, or it could be somebody who's a little older who may have had a little more extensive experience.
If you were to put a date range on it, or an age range, and I don't know if you go into that much detail for that, through where would you think you would put the age range?
I just would say early 20s. That's just what I would say. But like I said, that could be expanded if, I don't know enough about the demographics of the area or about anybody in the victim's circle who might have, like I said, grown up on a farm, been involved in graphic interactions with animals, you know, and may have been more immune to how gory and graphic what they did was.
As far as male, female, like obviously we're aware it could be either one, you know, working a profile. We're just kind of looking at, you know, what we think is most likely. You mentioned either one being a possibility. Do you lean one way or the other?
Like I said, the lifting of the shirt and the pulling down of the pants is something that a young male may do, exploratory in nature. But the anal thing, that took a lot, you know. But if this was a male who had no relationship with the victim, then I might think that some of the stabbing and some of the cuts were picurism. And that leans towards young and male too. But this went far beyond the force that was used. And the stomping, that was excessive. It wasn't necessary to accomplish what was accomplished. So I'm thinking there is a real possibility of it being a female offender because there's no intercourse, there's no ejaculate, you know, there's no proof that it was a male. So I'd say it leaves open the possibility of a female. And if you're right, and they never even considered a female, I would look for a female who may have had a history, like I said, you know, sort of the bully, the you know, violent, and the one who's working in sort of a male-dominated, tough environment, but also somebody who has, you know, no qualms about wet work. I mean, this is pretty nasty stuff. So they hit her over the head, they stabbed her with the fork, they cut her with the knife, they inserted things, they removed her clothing. All of these things took time, and all of these things, the strangulation as well, all of these things exposed them to greater and greater risk, which, yes, that does indicate a potentially young person, but you can't rule out that it's somebody who has more in terms of age, but they're also, their inhibitions were lowered by some kind of high stress or some kind of substance abuse. It's important that you don't put blinders on and get confirmation bias. But look at those things. Look at the husband and see, is it possible that he was doing pre-attack surveillance? Look at the whatever offenders that you, or potential offenders that you believe, and see what their background is. I don't believe that somebody who was, you know, a young female who was never involved in violence or aggression would have gone to the extent that this person went to. It would have been extremely disturbing to somebody who hasn't had some kind of history with either, you know, violence or animal husbandry, butchering, something that would make them more immune to this kind of gross behavior.
Jim's insights serve as the final piece to this puzzle that we've been working on to put together for 8 long months. We began this journey with no more than a few online articles about Jeanette's case. Now, after a full school year of work, we have hundreds of pages of police files, hours of recorded interviews, and after physically visiting Reed City, we now have a much better understanding of the crime scene itself. We used all that information to build our profile, and now that we have a stamp of approval from a professional behavioral analyst, along with his minor adjustments, we're now ready to do the thing Mr. Clementi advised us to wait on when we first met him all those months ago. It's time to finally apply our profile to the suspects in Jeanette's case. We'll begin with the known suspects, the people who have been scrutinized by internet sleuths for years. First up is a high school student we only know as Dale. Dale was looked at by the original investigators and was cleared. He seems to have had a bit of a crush on Jeanette. She talks about him stopping into the store on occasion in her diary. He does fit into the profile and the fact that he is young, and Jim told us that there are indications that the offender could be male. However, he does not fit in the profile because we have no indication that Dale had anything more than a crush on Jeanette. We have no reason to believe that he would be harboring the type of rage towards her that could result in this kind of violence. Also, he was still in high school at the time, which puts him a little too far outside of our potential age range, and most importantly, would alibi him if he was in fact in school that day. In the police file, when we sort through all of the redactions, it appears that it was ultimately confirmed that Dale was in school at the time of the murder. Next, we have a former Reed City cop named Theodore Platts. Platts had been fired from the department prior to Jeanette's murder for an incident involving himself and other officers at the bar located next to the gamble store. A lot has been made about Platts over the years because he was one of the first people to respond to the scene after Jeanette's body was discovered. Many people wondered why he was there at all, since he no longer worked for the department. Adding to the suspicion is the fact that he was fired due to an assault, which is an indicator of aggression and violent tendencies. Given the lack of any other viable suspects, these few facts has placed Platts at the top of a lot of people's suspect list. But when we compare Theodore Platts to our profile, he quickly fades away as a suspect. He was older and had years of law enforcement training. This doesn't fit at all with the idea of a disorganized and young offender. We also have no indication that he had any known personal relationship with Jeanette. Former Officer Platts doesn't come close at all to fitting into our profile. There have also been rumors throughout the years that one of the workers at Gamble's was responsible for Jeanette's murder. The simple fact is whoever killed Jeanette would have a lot of blood on them, and the offender also left the store with the murder weapons. There were no reports from any of the employees that any of their co-workers were missing or long enough to have committed the murder. No reports of anyone with blood on them, and no one left. Regardless of the profile, we don't believe any of the workers are viable suspects. Next, we move on to Jeanette's husband, Alvin.
Alvin has raised a lot of eyebrows for anyone looking into the case. His unusual trip to the store shortly before her murder, and the fact that not long after Jeanette's death, Alvin married and moved away with a young woman who was babysitting for their family at the time of the murder. We originally fully written Alvin off as a suspect, primarily because he was investigated by the original investigators and was cleared due to him having an alibi at the time of the murder. While the alibi still does clear him as an actual murderer, Jim Clemente's assessment of the crime has left us wondering if we wrote him off too soon. Alvin doesn't fit the profile of the actual offender, but what Jim suggested, that it seems to him that Alvin could have been conducting pre-offense surveillance for someone else, genuinely sent shivers down our spines. That's because there's only one person, someone who has been overlooked for 40 years, who does fit squarely into our profile. The Robinsons' 19-year-old babysitter, the woman who later married Alvin, Lisa Miracle. Lisa passed away several years ago, and as far as we've been able to find, she was never interviewed by police regarding Jeanette's murder. We also want to make it crystal clear that we are not accusing or implicating her in the crime. It is important to understand that a profile is not an endpoint where we determine guilt. It's intended to be a starting point to identify suspects to be investigated. And in this case, our profile is pointing directly at one such suspect. Lisa fits the profile in nearly every element. At 19, she's right on the cusp of our age range. She fits the elements that point to a female offender. She had had a romantic partner in common with Jeanette and Alvin. While we don't know with certainty what exactly was going on in those relationships, we can at least imagine a scenario where a potential love triangle could create anger or rage against Jeanette. In a world where Lisa might have imagined running away with Alvin, something she did ultimately do, Jeanette would have been a major obstacle in making that happen. When we add in Jim's analysis that Alvin may have stopped by the store to do pre-attack surveillance for the actual killer, again, there's only one person that we can find in all of this case material that he would have been doing that for. The woman who later replaced Jeanette in his life. Eight months ago, Mr. Ruff gave us a clear goal. Make a difference. Day after day, our classes began with him asking our group, "What are you going to do to move your case forward today?" There have been so many times where we felt like our work would be meaningless, that we were just spinning our wheels. But as months went by, we started to see progress. Then we met Lena and other people who knew Jeanette and loved her, and realized that the work we're doing is making a difference. And now, as we record this final episode, we feel that we can confidently say, mission accomplished. While we can't say that we solved the case, what we can say is we have made our difference. We have moved our case forward. We have developed a new investigative path that we hope will breathe new life into Jeanette's case. We know from our conversations with the state police detective in charge of the case that there is DNA evidence that we can compare to known suspects. At the conclusion of this season of our podcast, we will be sending in our findings to the detective and hope that he can, through genealogy or some other method, compare the known crime scene evidence to Lisa Miracle. In the meantime, this episode concludes our work on Jeanette's case for the school year. Stephanie, Riley, Aubrey, Carter, and Logan are all seniors. At the time of this recording, they've all graduated and began their lives outside of high school. But for me, I'm not done with Jeanette's case, not by a long shot. I still have FOIA requests that I'm waiting to receive, and now that we discovered a new direction, there is still more work to be done. I will be returning next school year. This will never be over for us until Jeanette and her family receive the justice they deserve. I've already enrolled in Mr. F's class, and you will be hearing more from me. And don't be surprised if some graduated seniors pop back in next year. on season 2 of Underestimated, Jeanette Robinson.
Underestimated. Jeanette Robertson was researched, written, and produced by Chelsea, Stephanie, Aubrey, Riley, Logan, and Carter. Intro music done by Haley. All other music done by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was also created by Chelsea. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping fund our work. Please make sure you leave us a review on your favorite podcast player. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.